Welcome to another broadcast from the Florida Free Speech Forum on WUFT and WJUF. This program was recorded for broadcast on Monday, September 14th, 2009, at the Paramount Plaza Hotel and Conference Center in Gainesville. And today's guest speaker will be Dr. Bruce Fogel, Associate Professor of the Department of Epidemiology and Health Policy Research and Director of the Division of Health Policy and Outcomes Research in the College of Medicine at the University of Florida. He is also a Research Health Scientist and Director of Methodology Corps at the Veterans Administration Rehabilitation Outcomes Research Center. He will speak today on the economics of healthcare and health reform. Carol Willis, President of the Florida Free Speech Forum, will open this program.
Good afternoon. I'm Carol Willis, this year's president of the Florida Free Speech Forum. Welcome to the September 14th, 2009 meeting as we start our 15th season. The Florida Free Speech Forum intends to serve as the foremost bastion of free speech in the southeastern United States. Our forum does not endorse candidates nor take sides on issues other than the issue of exercising the right to free speech, and to that mission, we are committed with passion. Your questions after the presentation make an important contribution to the forum. This year, our forums will be broadcast on WUFT-FM and WJUF-FM on the first Sunday of the month at 11 a.m., and today I want to take a moment to recognize the contribution Bill Beckett makes to the success of the forums. Every month when we come for our meetings, Bill is already here, all set up with the equipment ready to record our speaker and the questions session. Bill's recordings and the later broadcasts have always seemed to go off without a hitch. But what does he do during the rest of the week? He's the program director for WUFT-FM and its sister station, WJUF-FM. The Federal Communications Commission says that one of the most important things a broadcast station can do is to make itself a local institution. Nobody has done more to make WUFT-FM a local institution than Bill Beckett. For more information about the Florida Free Speech Forum, you may visit our website at http://floridafreespeech.org. There you will find upcoming program information, archives of past programs, a membership form, and a means to communicate with the forum leadership through email. And when you join the forum, please do give us your email so that we may communicate with you in a timely manner. Today, we're pleased to have two students from Buchholz High School and their teacher, Kirsten Flamand. Welcome. Please remember that we respect all opinions at the forums. When the floor is open for questions, please come to the microphone, state your name, and ask your question. The forum meets at the Paramount Resort and Conference Center in Gainesville, Florida, from 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. on the second Monday of the month, September through May. Reservations can be made by calling 335-3938 no later than the Thursday before the Monday of the meeting. And now Paul Hargrave will introduce today's speaker.
Thank you, Carol. It's my pleasure to introduce our speaker for today, Dr. Bruce Fogel. He is Associate Professor of the Department of Epidemiology and Health Policy Research and Director of the Division of Health Policy and Outcomes Research there in the College of Medicine at the University of Florida. He's also a Research Health Scientist and Director of the Methodology Corps at the Veterans Administration Rehabilitation Outcomes Research Center. Dr. Fogel is a PhD economist by training and has extensive experience in analyses of healthcare cost and utilization data from a wide variety of private, state, and federal sources. He's also provided advice and expertise on health policy issues to numerous state and federal agencies. He's going to speak to us today on the title, Cautionary Tales from the Dismal Science, the Economics of Healthcare and Health Reform. Dr. Fogel.
Thank you very much, Paul. I'd like to thank the Florida Free Speech Forum for giving me this opportunity to talk about this topic. I think I probably join you in saying that this could not be more timely, period in which to discuss the economics of healthcare and healthcare reform. We were reading about it every day in the newspaper, and I'm going to try to give you some very preliminary answers to a total of 7 questions that I've outlined that I think you might find of interest. I should start, before I start my questions or start answering my questions, I should mention that the views I express here today are my own views, and they do not represent the state of Florida, the University of Florida, the Department of Veterans Affairs, or the federal government in any way, shape, or form. So with that disclaimer, let me just review briefly the questions I'm going to try to address today briefly. Why does the U.S. spend so much on health care? That's perhaps a fundamental question when we talk about the economics of healthcare. Second question, are we getting our money's worth from the money we're spending on healthcare? 3, can we really improve access to healthcare while controlling costs? 4, how much will healthcare reform cost? 5, how did we get into this mess in the first place? 6, why hasn't anyone done anything about it before now? And 7, the question that I think will spend most of our time on, especially during the discussion, is what can we do about it now? Okay, going back to why does the U.S. spend so much on health care? Does anybody know how much we spend on health care annually in the U.S.? $2.2 trillion, I believe, is the figure, the most recent figure. Extraordinary amount. Not only that, we spend a higher percentage of our gross domestic product on health care than any other industrialized country by far. So when we talk about the healthcare cost crisis, it's in absolute terms a very large amount of money, and we seem to be spending more than anyone else on healthcare. Why is this? Well, there are a multitude of reasons that have been cited concerning why we spend so much on healthcare. We hear a lot today about the excess profits of insurance companies, the excess profits of drug companies. We hear a great deal about defensive medicine, whereby physicians order tests and procedures that may not be clinically necessary, but simply protect them from lawsuits. In this era of healthcare reform, we're hearing a lot about waste, fraud, and abuse, especially in the federal Medicare program, and indeed many of the healthcare reform proposals are suggesting that reductions in waste, fraud, and abuse can be used to improve access to care through universal health insurance coverage. Economists have paid a lot of attention, as you might expect, to payment mechanisms and their role in contributing to health care inflation. Many of you are probably familiar with the term fee-for-service medicine. In the U.S., traditionally, physicians have been paid based on the quantity of services they provide the patient. Along the same lines, hospitals traditionally have been paid based on their levels of costs. The more services, the higher the costs, the greater the insurance payment. And many economists have noted that the incentives in such payment systems are inherently inflationary. But in my opinion, if you were to poll economists who study healthcare and ask what is the single most important factor or the single combination of factors, I think most economists would argue that it's a combination of widespread, relatively generous health insurance combined with the rapid diffusion of high-cost healthcare innovations. Those two factors together, most economists would argue, have accounted for more healthcare cost increases over time than any of the other factors I cited at the outset. So health insurance is something we all want, something we all need. It provides many wonderful benefits. It protects people like us from catastrophic financial consequences. It improves access to care for not only people like us, but people of lower income who may not have accumulated wealth to protect financially, but nevertheless need a way of paying for health care. So health insurance is very beneficial. And in a similar fashion, rapid rates of technological progress in healthcare have also been very beneficial. No one really disputes this. But those two factors combined arguably have contributed significantly to America's healthcare cost problem. In and of itself, high costs may not be a problem, except when it comes to the question of, are we getting our money's worth? As many of you probably know, when we look at health status statistics internationally, the U.S. does not rank as highly as one might hope. In particular, although we spend the most per capita on health care of any developed countries, many of our health statistics are not at the top. In fact, many of them are closer to the bottom. Great example is neonatal and infant mortality rates. Here in the U.S., neonatal and infant mortality rates are among the lower echelons of developed countries internationally. And in similar fashions, life expectancy in the U.S. is not as high as we might hope. And it's a combination of our high-cost healthcare system combined with health status indicators that may not be where we think they should be that leads many economists and many health policy experts to argue that perhaps we aren't getting everything we need or everything we deserve from our healthcare expenditures. Some economists like Victor Fuchs at Stanford have argued that the U.S. health system is really cost unconscious. We spend a great deal amount of money on healthcare without weighing and considering what those extra high expenditures are giving us in terms of improvements in health status. So, in this era of health reform, we know we have high costs. We know we have problems with many health status measures. The real goal in healthcare reform, by and large, is to improve access to care through expanding insurance coverage while simultaneously controlling costs. Can we do that? Can we really improve access while controlling costs? Well, different people have different opinions, but I would say most economists agree with the Congressional Budget Office. The Congressional Budget Office has argued that universal coverage, as it's being planned in Congress right now, will increase healthcare costs over the long run. And in particular, I think originally the Congressional Budget Office estimated that the extra cost of healthcare reform would be somewhere around $1.5 trillion over 10 years. And more recently, that's come down a bit under some different proposals, maybe more like $1 trillion, or at least in the high hundreds of billions of dollars. Now, if you're like me, you grew up in the era of millions or billions of dollars. And we all had trouble, if I recall, when we made this transition to billions from millions. I know I had trouble as a young person getting my head around what it means to spend $1 billion. And as I was making these estimates and as I was talking about, as I was thinking about what I was going to say today, I thought, boy, I really don't have a very good intuitive feeling for what $1 trillion is. So I made some calculations. If you had $1.5 trillion bills, what could you do with it? And I tried to think, well, the usual is how many times will it circle the Earth, or how many times can you send it to the moon and back, or something like that. I thought, well, what if you simply covered the countryside with dollar bills? For example, how many times, if you had $1.5 trillion bills, could you cover the land area of Alachua County? Think you could make it once? Twice? If my calculations are right, and I don't really know if they are, somewhere between 6 and 7 times over. Put in another way, if you were to pick a state, you could use 90% of that $1.5 trillion bills to cover the state of Connecticut. A lot of money, no question about it. So in answer to the question, can we really improve access while controlling costs? Probably not under the present system. Okay, it's going to be a net cost to us. It may be $1 trillion. Some of the calculations I've made suggest it could be over 10 years as high as $3.4 trillion. But in a system with $2.2 trillion outlay annually, that's a large number, but it's not like we're going to likely double or triple our healthcare expenditures, heaven forbid. Still, it's going to be a costly undertaking under the present healthcare system. So what I've tried to do now in answering these questions very, very briefly is to give you sort of an overview of where we are. We spend a lot of money. We have great access to high technology care in the U.S., but many of our health statistics, our longevity statistics, our infant mortality statistics maybe aren't as good as we had hoped. And if we want to expand coverage, if we want to achieve universal access to health care, it's likely under this expensive system going to cost more money. So now to a bit of history. How did we get into this mess in the first place? Health insurance, as some of you may know, is a relatively recent phenomenon in the insurance industry. In the 1920s, it was argued strenuously that sickness was not an insurable event. If you think about traditional insurance, if a tree falls on your house or your car is in an accident, the damages are pretty well defined. That is, an insurance adjuster can look at your house or look at your car and say, it's going to cost X dollars to fix. Healthcare, on the other hand, is much harder to grasp. It's much harder to define the loss. It's even hard to define whether healthcare services are going to make you whole again. It's in this case, literally and figuratively. You may be familiar with the insurance terminology where the goal of insurance is to make the recipient of the insurance whole should they suffer loss. In healthcare, it's very hard to make those kinds of well-defined decisions. Well, in the late 20s and early 30s, Blue Cross Blue Shield changed all that. They demonstrated once and for all that health was indeed an insurable event. And Blue Cross Blue Shield expanded greatly. Commercial insurance companies learned, and they came into the market for health insurance. And health insurance has prospered ever since. You might ask yourself the question, though, how did health insurance become so intertwined with employment? Does anybody know the answer to that? When it became? World War II. This is a great case of unintended consequences. In World War II, we had, in the U.S., wage price controls. They were necessary because of the need for very, very large increases in war production. So rather than allowing wages and prices to rise dramatically, we put wage price controls on. Defense contractors, the people who were making the tanks, airplanes, guns, and so forth for World War II, however, needed to draw workers to their plants. But they could not compete for workers by increasing wages. So what did they do? They took advantage of labor law, and they provided health insurance as a fringe benefit to their employees in order to attract new workers. And that's really how employment-based health insurance became institutionalized in the U.S. Almost an incidental path. It was not a deliberate policy choice that anybody made. It just became institutionalized through World War II wage price controls. And here we are. People who today who don't have employment-based health insurance have a great deal of difficulty getting health care insurance, in part because individual policies are more expensive than employment group-based policies. Why is that? Does anyone know? The economists talk about the term adverse selection. And we're not going to get into the technology and the issues related to health insurance too deeply. But in a nutshell, studies have shown, insurance companies know, that people who seek out individual health policies have higher claims experience than people who don't, and in particular, higher than people who have their insurance through employment groups. Okay, in other words, in insurance jargon, the individual insurance market suffers adverse selection. Okay, so as a result, premiums are higher in the individual market than they are in group markets. So if you're not part of an employment group, it's much less easy to afford health insurance. Not only that, this is a major factor also, as many of you know, employers' contributions to health insurance are not taxed, okay? And that is a great benefit to those of us who are employed and whose employer contributes to our health insurance. Interestingly enough, many health policy advocates have argued that that's a wonderful thing. It reduces the cost of health insurance and therefore promotes coverage, and we should preserve it. Many economists, however, argue that it makes, this is hard to believe, health insurance too cheap relative to other goods and services. Many economists have argued that the price of insurance, especially employment-based insurance, is artificially low and historically has led to too generous first dollar insurance coverage. That's become less of a problem through time because, as we all know, health insurance policies have become much more stringent about their coverage. There are increased deductibles, increased co-payments, and so forth these days. But economists are one of the few groups who really think that they're one of the few groups among health policy experts who really approve of the Obama's administration's proposal to tax health insurance premiums. Question number six, why hasn't anyone done anything about this before now? Well, because many of you in the room here are older, you know we've tried. In fact, it's been said that national health care and health care reform have been on the presidential agenda for every president since Harry Truman. And many of you will remember just a scant 15 years ago, we went through the Clinton health reform effort, which looked very promising for a period of time and ultimately failed. It looked out a few months ago as if President Obama was going to succeed where others have failed. And now the question really is, what kind of health care reform are we going to get from this complex political process we're going through? It looks as if it may not be as comprehensive as originally proposed. So that brings me to that last question, which I want to spend a good bit of time on, and I suspect we'll want to have an exchange of ideas about. What can we do about it now? I sort of class healthcare reform into two areas. One is revamping insurance to ensure access to care, and the other is changing healthcare provision to control costs and improve the quality of care. In terms of revamping insurance, we have a variety of options, two main options. One is single-payer healthcare, where the government takes over the financing of healthcare and essentially performs the function presently performed by health insurance companies. Or number two, some system of mandates where individuals or employers are required to purchase health insurance. In an individual mandate system, individuals would be required to sign up for health insurance, and under an employer mandate system, all employers would be required to insure their workers. So, single payer. How many of you in this room are in favor of single payer healthcare? Is it unanimous? Close. How many are not in favor of single payer healthcare? Okay, single payer definitely wins, but there's some diversity here. That's good. To me, the best argument in favor of single payer healthcare is the high levels of satisfaction with the Canadian system. The Canadian system has single-payer health care, and Canadians are far more satisfied with their health care system than Americans are with theirs. Interestingly, though, in the U.S., there's a real dichotomy between our opinions about our health care system and our individual health care arrangements. Many Americans are dissatisfied with the system, but they're very happy with their individual health care arrangements. They like their doctors. Okay? And it's almost as if we have said we want health care reform because we don't like the fact that so many Americans are uninsured and unable to access care. But while you're at it, you got to get a handle on these runaway health care costs. And by the way, don't you dare touch my own personal health care arrangements. To me, this is mission impossible. But that is almost, I think, what we as a country have asked our policymakers to do. Single payer, like I said, I think the major argument in favor of single payer is the satisfaction with the Canadians system that Canadians have. The other argument that's commonly cited is the U.S. Medicare system, because satisfaction in the U.S. Medicare system is higher than under private insurance. To me, the Medicare evidence is somewhat weaker because Medicare is not actuarially sound at present. As many of you may know, Medicare, at least Part A Medicare, the so-called Hospital Insurance Trust Fund, is scheduled to go broke. And any of you know when it is scheduled to go broke? Next year? No, not next year. I was surprised. I looked at the latest Medicare trustees report. 2019, 10 years from now. Medicare is likely going to have to undergo dramatic changes between now and 2019. But Canada remains as sort of a model system for U.S. consideration. In terms of mandates, lots of politicians like the idea of an employer mandate. Why? Because it appears costless, right? If you force people to go out and buy their own health insurance, well, you're going to lose votes doing that, because people who don't want health insurance or don't want to have to pay for it are not going to be like being told what to do. But if you mandate that employers must provide their workers with health insurance, you may have a political winner, because it means those dastardly employers are going to have to fork out the money to provide the worker with health care. Unfortunately, that appealing political scenario, economists don't believe. Economists, again, are almost unanimous in their opinion that over time, health insurance premiums are shifted back upon the worker in the form of lower wages. Economists, again, almost unanimously believe that the incidence of employer-paid health insurance premiums eventually fall back on the worker in the form of lower wages. So that's a major weakness with employer mandates from an economic perspective. Do you really want low-income workers who presently don't have health insurance to get health insurance, but correspondingly have even lower wages than they do now? So that's a weakness for the employer mandate option. Individual mandates, again, forcing people to buy health insurance is perhaps less politically palatable. And also because, remember I mentioned adverse selection in individual markets? Well, it's possible that an individual mandate could overcome that, because essentially, rather than just having sick people presently in the individual health insurance market, if it were mandated that everybody join who presently doesn't have health insurance, the problem of adverse selection would presumably be lessened. But again, politically, individual mandates may not be too popular. I think it's important when we talk about insurance options to keep in mind what insurance can and cannot do. In particular, from an actuarial perspective, insurance is about protecting against financial catastrophe. In essence, with health insurance, what you're really doing is trading a small predictable loss, financial loss, which we call the monthly premium, for protection against the highly uncertain, potentially large catastrophic loss. Okay? That works well for people like us who have some nest egg that we want to protect. But one big issue that's related to insurance that we often ask insurance to fix is the issue of redistribution of welfare in our society. I think it's useful to keep those two things separate, because insurance works well as financial protection, but it doesn't necessarily work well as a system of redistributing welfare. I think, for example, if we were to impose an individual mandate on citizens, that would have to be accompanied, and I think everybody agrees, with subsidies for lower income individuals in our societies. Why? Poor people simply can't afford health insurance. Do you know how much we spend per capita on healthcare in the U.S.? It's $7,400 a year, a very substantial amount. And I think it's very useful to have public discussion about who can and who cannot afford health insurance. Medicaid, as many of you know, provides health insurance to some poor people. But Medicaid is very limited in the sense that it only covers people below 100 or typically 150% of poverty. That's very, very low income. And the people who don't have health insurance, by and large, are the so-called working poor, or increasingly, the working lower middle class, who simply aren't making enough money to be able to afford these very, very high insurance premiums. So, where do we stand? I hope I've given you some idea as I've moved through these questions as to some of the issues involved. Economists do speak with one voice on a couple of things, for example, about the incidence of employer mandates and the fact that insurance costs are ultimately shifted back on workers. But economists, or economics really, is better at telling us what might not work or what might have unintended consequences than it is at telling us what is definitely the best option available. That's why I termed my talk today Cautionary Tales from the Dismal Science. Economists are very good at saying, that may not be such a good idea. But when you come to an economist and say, well, what should we do? you hear far less certainty about what we should do. So I hope I'm not setting too negative a tone for the interchange to come, but that is sort of my take on these seven important questions. Thank you. We have a first question.
Two hopefully very quick questions. My name is Neil White, by the way. You've mentioned the high cost we have in this country and the poor outcomes. To what extent is the statistics of poor outcomes because of the number of uninsured that we have?
Hard to say. A lot of critics of the statistics I cited argue that the outcomes where we really lag, like infant and neonatal mortality, aren't simply because of lack of health insurance. It's because of lifestyle factors and poverty together. And so it's very hard to say to what extent the lack of health insurance reduces our health status measures. If you look at the amount that the uninsured spend, it's only about 60% of the average amount that Americans spend who have health insurance. But the problem with that is many of the uninsured are relatively young and healthy, so you would expect them to have lower expenditures. Mm-hmm. The problem in terms of the uninsured, from my perspective, you can argue that the young who don't have health insurance are a problem, but to me the more severe problem are the older people who have low incomes, who don't qualify for Medicaid, and who aren't able to afford health care. Oftentimes, though, when they do get access to health care, expenditures do go up initially. That's one issue to keep in mind. There's often what you might call suppressed demand that ultimately comes into play when people become insured. So I'm not really answering your question, but I'm trying to answer around it where I can.
Okay. The other thing was you mentioned that you thought the Canadian system was the best argument for a single-payer system. What about the fact that if there were a single-payer system, there'd be a lot less paperwork, a lot less bureaucracy, because it's just immediately paid. You know who's going to pay it. You don't have to shuttle papers.
We were discussing this at lunch. To me, one of the best features of the Clinton Health Reform Plan was standardization of insurance paperwork. One-page claim form. That makes a lot of sense. And why, you know, it was not passed because nothing was passed in the Clinton health care reform package. That makes a great deal of sense. And I don't know how many people argue in favor of the current level of health insurance paperwork.
I'm Jenny Brown. I'm with the Alachua County Labor Party, and we advocate for a single-payer system. I appreciated your interesting point that insurance works as a protection for assets, but not really as a way of distributing a good. And I wanted to see if you could just address specifically this bill in Congress, H.R. 676. The mechanism for payment is a 3.3% employer and employee payroll tax, so it's funded similar to Medicare, and under that bill, several studies have shown that it actually would pay for everybody's health care needs. So I just wanted to see if you could react to that. Thanks.
I'm not familiar with the financial calculations on that. I don't know if that would be sufficient or not. Do you know what the Congressional Budget Office says about it? Are they the ones?
When a single-payer bill was introduced several years ago, they did a study and they said it was certainly the most efficient and that it would cover people's needs, yeah.
Most economists, again, would be concerned, I think, about the employer portion of that being passed on to the worker in the form of lower wages. Ultimately, economists believe that employers make decisions based on the full cost of their employees, and it doesn't matter whether it's wages or health insurance premiums or employer taxes for health insurance premiums. So that would be an issue, I think. Again, I can't address the ultimate financial burden of that.
But private insurance premiums are also that are paid by the employer then would also be being passed on.
Yes,
so this
definitely.
And even if you counted all of it together, it would still be less than most employers and employees in combination are paying for health insurance for the employers that are covering it, right?
Well, if you're asking what is the most efficient insurance mechanism, economists aren't necessarily in a place to tell you that. it becomes a matter of what kinds of insurance premiums are feasible. That is, in a competitive market, you would look at the levels of insurance premiums and look at their distribution and measure the, well, some people measure what is called the payout ratio. That is the ratio that insurance companies pay to the amount of money they take in. And in general, insurance pools pay out a very high percentage of their revenues in terms of benefits. The cost of insurance in terms of administration and so forth, so-called overhead expenses, is that amount that they keep after they pay out benefits. And it's well less than 10% in most cases. So I'm not sure I'm answering your question. I'm not sure
well,
I can.
In the case of Medicare, it's 3%, right?
Yes.
So,
and it's actually that's a very good.
So private thing. Insurance has a lot less, is making more money off of us than Medicare is, I guess. Okay.
Well, you might make that argument. I'm not sure I would without further study, but you certainly could.
Good afternoon. My name's Alan March. I wanted to change for a moment the focus from health care reform to health reform, actually improving the health status of individual people. Now, that would mean changing, be a form of demand management to actually change the demand curve based on the health status of individuals. We recognize that all health care does not enhance health. As a matter of fact, health care is only one component. Who we chose as our parents is very important, and what we do for ourselves is really the most important thing. Can you address some of the issues, economic considerations, for some mechanisms for improving the health status of individuals and how that would affect the debate on health care reform?
I don't think anyone would seriously argue that the kinds of things we do for ourselves, nutrition, lifestyle, exercise, not smoking, and so forth, those things are very important to improving health. There's no question that we Americans have concentrated on our healthcare system as a means of improving health, and many would argue that that is not necessarily the most economical way. I would agree with you. I think a lot of experts would agree with you. The more difficult political question is, what kinds of restrictions are you going to place on people and their ability to make choices? For example, what are we going to outlaw? Should we be outlawing trans fats, as New York City proposed? Should we be outlawing tobacco? We seem to be in the process of doing that right now, so gradually. But those are political questions that go well beyond economics. But I agree with you. Health policy has concentrated not exclusively, but extensively on health insurance as a means of accessing care and improving health. There are many other ways, including individual decisions about factors that affect your own health.
I'm Jean Chalmers. Years ago, I had a degree in health planning. Worked on the fringes of that. Worked with Carrie Kilpatrick, as a matter of fact. So been on the fringes of the healthcare delivery for years. Two comments and then two questions. I have three elderly siblings in poor health in Canada. They are getting fantastic care. I had a sister-in-law with brain cancer in Canada, was sent down to Seattle for her radiation, and when I asked the physicians why, when Vancouver's so close, they said, we're waiting for enough people to have a second radiation center in Vancouver. In the meantime, it's cheaper for us to send them to Seattle, where you ignore your certificate of needs, and you have a radiation center that is only half utilized, and you give a discount to we Canadians to help you get your certificate of need. So when you hear about how these people come to the United States because they can't get service in Canada, you just have to think, them Canadians sure are smart. Now, I have two questions. Why don't we look at the French system? Are we so anti-French that we don't look at it? It is quite a private system controlled by the government. They have one piece of paper. They have one card. It's an X, and the Spanish system, somewhat the same. It's not a government single-payer system, but it's a system that is very, very well controlled. And so I would really like us to have another look at that system. The second question is, why don't we expand public health? When public health started, it was to take care of contagious diseases. Have you been into an emergency room lately? 50% of it is contagious diseases. So my two questions, the French system and the public health system.
I'm not in the best position. Paul Hargrave and I were talking about the French system during lunch. I'm not the best person to address the French system. But in general, when you look internationally at different healthcare systems, what I'm most struck by is the diversity of ways in which not just healthcare is financed, but the way it's, ways it's delivered. As I was telling Paul Hargrave, in some countries, the way in which healthcare is delivered would border on medical malpractice in the United States. For example, in Japan, the Japanese have many, many more healthcare visits annually on average than we Americans. But each one is amazingly short, like 3 minutes each. It's hard to conceive of how that would work in the United States. But what it points out is we have here in the United States a very fixed idea of what medical care consists of, and also some very Byzantine ways in which it's financed. But I think you're right. There's a lot that we could learn internationally, not just about healthcare financing, but about the provision of healthcare and the style and the ways in which we combine inputs to produce health.
Emily Brown.
Yes.
How much would the negotiation of pharmacy, big pharma, down to normal rates such as they have in Congress make a difference?
That gets into the thorny question, which is hotly debated among economists, of what would happen if we lowered pharmaceutical prices. The pharmaceutical industry tells us that would greatly reduce the rates of innovation and the discovery of new drugs. They make the argument that they have to have high profit rates on the drugs that succeed because they have such high expenditures on drugs that don't succeed. And economists are all over the board on that. There are economists who believe that is absolutely false, that pharmaceutical companies are making excess profits and that therefore we should restrict their patents and so forth in order to lower costs. It would have an impact. I can't tell you how big of an impact, but it would definitely lower healthcare costs. The question is, would we be able to lower healthcare costs with no consequences, or would it have negative effects in terms of the rate of flow of new drugs to market? And again, I can tell you that economists do not speak with one voice on that issue. They're all over the place. And it is a subject of great debate.
David Chalmers, I am not a health planner. I have a suggestion.
Yes.
And a question. Suggestion is asking the Florida Free Speech Forum to please put together a program on the Canadian health system. Now, my second point or question really is about leakages within the society. On a CBS program, Katie Couric last week, they totaled up the insurance company profits after everything is $11 billion a year. Pharmaceuticals was $33 billion a year. You would add to this, and these are not necessarily leakages, but they're things to be considered. Last year, three hedge fund operators each made $3 billion after almost no taxes, because hedge funds are in an almost exempt from tax situation, very low set of taxes. There is always the argument over pharmaceuticals, over the cost of innovation and the cost of merchandising in one way or another. When we deal with the nature of the costs and reducing the costs, there are so many leakages, or what I would call leakages in society, that they would make, or then this is my question, would not the leakages themselves constitute a major form, a major way of dealing with the costs of the health system?
By leakages, you're referring to, for example, drug company profits?
I'm saying within the drug company profits, mm-hmm. I assume that there is a portion of it that I would identify as leakages, yes.
Yeah, the question is what percentage of drug company profits might be considered excess. Economists have a very standard definition. Excess profits are those profits that are above and beyond the amount necessary to keep the present level of capital in the industry. Okay? Economists have sort of a Goldilocks theory of profits. Profits can be below normal, in which case firms exit the industry because they're not earning a competitive rate of return. They can be normal, which is just enough to keep people in but not draw new entry, or they can be excessive. When profits are excessive and there are no barriers to entry, presumably competitors will come into the marketplace in order to reap those higher profits. And in so doing, they tend to drive prices down. In pharmaceuticals, we have a problem with that because of patents. And again, we could spend hours talking about the patent system. Patents are, in essence, legal monopolies. And presumably, we grant these legal monopolies to patents to encourage inventors to develop new ideas. Critics of the pharmaceutical industry argue that pharmaceutical companies make too much money, they have excessive patent life, and not only that, they develop new Me Too drugs that are patentable but are very similar to existing drugs solely because so they can reap excess profits and patent protection from competition. So there are all kinds of proposals out there. I don't know the correct answer. But you have to be careful not to assume that, why don't we just take all the profits of the drug companies and use it to reduce healthcare costs or provide insurance to other people? If you did that, if you took every dollar of excess revenue over expenses, most economists would predict you would see mass exodus from the pharmaceutical company and from the pharmaceutical industry. In particular, they would not be earning a normal rate of return on invested capital. So the question is, how much is excess? And because if there are excess profits out there, they could be taxed or in other ways appropriated without harming the industry.
At least an area that's well worth study. Thank you.
I can give you probably 36 citations from the recent economics literature. It is hotly discussed and debated, and it is researched. Unfortunately, definitive answers are harder to come by than you might hope. Yes.
Joy Barnes. I hear a lot about outcome and outcome studies,
yes.
And I was wondering if you could address that.
I do some of those studies. I do what some people call comparative effectiveness research, and some of the healthcare reform bills are talking about promoting or expanding comparative effectiveness research. The idea is very sensible. If we don't know everything that works in healthcare, or we're not always able to make judgments between alternative treatments, we need to improve the scientific base, the so-called evidence base of medical practice. A major way of doing that is through conducting more clinical trials, more outcomes analysis, and thereby improving the foundation on which medical decision making is made. That sounds great in theory. It's very hard to do in practice because medical technology is always changing. The study that was done 5 years ago that cost $50 million that told us that treatment A is better than treatment B may be obsolete now because treatment C and treatment D have come along and stand the potential of being improvements yet again. Okay, so the pace of technological change in healthcare makes it hard to have a definitive evidence base. One of the issues I always point out to people is that comparative effectiveness research is not going to be, for the foreseeable future, a panacea about making healthcare more efficient because it's always going to lag behind technology. And moreover, one big concern I have is that comparative effectiveness analysis, rather than providing us with clinical practice guidelines, as they do now, will be interpreted by payors as clinical practice rules. I think most clinicians would agree that there is no such thing as ironclad rules that can always be applied. There's always clinical judgment that needs to come into play. So I think comparative effectiveness analysis has a role to play. I think it's worthwhile expanding the work, but clinical practice guidelines will always be guidelines, should not be interpreted as ironclad rules. I'm not sure that answers your question, but that's the best I can do.
Hi, I'm Shirley Bloodworth.
Yes.
I come from a very practical perspective on this. I realize that the whole justice of dividing up healthcare, but I would like to say I'm confused sometimes as to whether I'm the consumer or whether the insurance company is the consumer. And I think the people in this room who are aging are really in the throes of this whole debate. Mm-hmm. Because on Medicare, you don't know what you're paying. You have no idea what the costs are. Every time a doctor suggests something, you have to internally decide, well, is my life on the line or isn't it? I have no idea what it will cost, and I won't pay for it anyway. And until this becomes more apparent to us, and we are the consumers of a lot of tests, mm-hmm. until this becomes apparent to us and we can make a voice that's sensible about this use of all the medical technology, I think we have trouble.
I would agree with you, and you may be dismayed to learn that you're not the only person who doesn't know how much those tests and procedures cost. Surveys have been done of clinicians, and physicians have a surprisingly high level of ignorance of the cost of different tests and procedures. And so, you know, it goes back to what Victor Fuchs calls a cost-unconscious medical system. Here's a thought experiment for you. Imagine for a moment that we outlawed health insurance tomorrow. My goodness, you say that would be the most awful, terrible thing. Yes, it would. I'm not proposing that we do so. But think about how the practice of medicine would change. I would argue that rather than the physician saying, what can I do to help this patient? The question would be modified to, what can I do to help this patient without driving them bankrupt? That could be very beneficial in terms of identifying those medical services that aren't absolutely essential or that don't meet your individual criterion as to willingness to pay.
Sam Greenberg.
Yes.
What kind of bill do you expect to come out of Congress that President Obama can sign?
You're asking an economist to predict politics. We have enough trouble with economics. I guess I believe those people who say that the public option is not going to pass the Senate. At least that seems to be a lot of what I'm hearing. But we will have healthcare reform. That's my prediction. It will be labeled healthcare reform. It will be less than originally intended, but it will be a step in the direction of universal coverage. How's that for a safe prediction? A safe yet meaningless prediction.
Alan Overman, I think my question is simple. Recently, we read in the press of a $2.5 billion settlement of the government with one of the drug companies. Could you enlighten us, what is this about? And specifically, who will get the $2.5 billion that's collected?
Boy, I wish I could. Does anybody know what settlement he's referring to?
Pfizer.
And it was a settlement over what? I'm sorry, I'm ignorant of this. They lied about what they're doing, okay? So it's a $2.5 billion settlement with Pfizer over deceptive advertising. It's coming back to me now. I think I know what you're referring to. Pardon?
It was two fines. One was for deceptive advertising, and the other was for overcharging the government system. And that was a reimbursement kind of thing.
That will go to your federal government, my federal government, and it will either be spent or used to reduce the deficit. Want to take a guess on which it's going to be? No, I think most economists support antitrust laws. They support many of the regulations of the Federal Trade Commission because you do have to have rules in order for competitive markets to work, despite what Milton Friedman says. Go ahead.
Hi, my name's Jay Whitehead. Could you comment as an economist on how the whole question would change if instead we changed from a fee-for-service basis for medical care to a capitation basis?
How would things change? Capitation, for those of you who can remember the 1970s, you may remember a term called health maintenance organizations, HMOs, which is only three letters. Many people think it was four letters. Capitation was, when I started studying healthcare in the mid-1970s, the future savior of the healthcare system. Capitation was going to generate all kinds of efficiencies because it got us away from paying more when more services are provided. There was a slight problem with that, with physician practices in particular. Individual physicians didn't see enough patients in order for capitation broadly defined to work. In other words, The reason insurance companies can charge a fixed premium and cover all healthcare costs for a group is because they have very, very, very large numbers. What's financially unpredictable for the individual becomes relatively predictable in large pools. Well, physician practice panels may number a few hundred, few thousand patients, depending on the specialty. They're not large enough for the physician to, in a sense, bear the risk of catastrophic expenditures. So capitation was a great idea, but it has to be applied to a broad enough group, okay? And increasingly what we're seeing in health insurance arrangements, I agree with the people who've said that it's become really complex, it has. We see capitation carve-outs. Capitation for primary care is something that is much more feasible than global capitation for individual providers. But the real thing that I think shot HMOs down were the hard, what some people call hard lock-ins. In an HMO, you had to see a physician who was a member of the HMO's panel. If you went outside that panel, you got no coverage whatsoever. And people did not like that. That's one reason preferred provider organizations, which give you a discount if you see one of the preferred providers, but still provide you with some coverage should you see somebody who's not a preferred provider, have become more popular. But capitation was at one time thought to be the ultimate answer to healthcare crises, cost crises. And it hasn't proven to be the case yet. Yes?
Hi, Joe Quarter. Could you just lay out for me, what is the positive role insurance companies play in the delivery of healthcare system?
Is this a challenging question? I would argue that they should have very little to do with the delivery of healthcare. Health insurance works best when it's about protecting from financial catastrophe. Okay? Let me leave you, we're about to finish up. Let me leave you with one very provocative thought. And this is heresy, okay? Don't quote me on this. Turn off your recorder. No. I have often wondered in recent years, as healthcare costs have skyrocketed, whether those commercial insurance executives from the 1920s were ultimately correct. Sickness is not an insurable event. What has happened is we have found insurance to be feasible, but along with insurance has come this tidal wave of cost increases. But if what you're referring to more specifically is the role of health insurance in terms of reducing utilization, you know, I share the same concerns as many of you when it comes to a clerk with a flowchart in front of them telling a doctor what he or she can or cannot do to a patient.
Time for one more question.
Not. Talk later.
Yeah, he'll stay for talk. I want to thank you for your very stimulating talk give you a free speech forum mug and also a membership for a year in our forum. So we hope you'll come back. Thank you very much. And I want to announce that our next forum is Monday, October 12th, and will feature John Mills, former Speaker of the House, on the topic Privacy, the Last Right. The Florida Free Speech Forum is now adjourned.
You've been listening to the Florida Free Speech Forum on WUFT and WJUF. Today's guest speaker was Dr. Bruce Fogel, Associate Professor of the Department of Epidemiology and Health Policy Research and Director of the Division of Health Policy and Outcomes Research in the College of Medicine at the University of Florida. He is also a Research Health Scientist and Director of Methodology Corps at the Veterans Administration Rehabilitation Outcomes Research Center. He spoke today on the economics of healthcare and health reform. You can listen to this program again on the WUFT-FM archive by going to wuftfm.org/archive. That's wuftfm.org/archive. Look for Florida Free Speech Forum with Dr. Bruce Fogel. This program was recorded for broadcast on Monday, September 14th, 2009, at the Paramount Plaza Hotel and Conference Center in Gainesville. The recording engineer and producer was Bill Beckett, and this has been a production of WUFT-FM in Gainesville and WJUF in Inverness, and we are a public broadcasting service of the University of Florida.